Hey, Mike here. I just wanted to let you know that you can listen to Dark Poutine early and ad-free on Amazon Music, included with Prime.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit amazon.com/prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
Welcome back to Dark Poutine. My name is Mike Brown, and I'm coming to you from the Dark Poutine studio in Langley, British Columbia. And my good friend Matthew is away this week. Where the heck are you, Matthew, right now?
The satellite Dark Poutine studio in Edmonton, Alberta.
Edmonton, Alberta. Oh my goodness gracious. How long are you there?
I'm here for the weekend. I'm seeing my auntie and uncle.
You know that Morgan lives in Edmonton,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, I forgot about that.
You might want to say hi. Some people might want to meet you. Are you going to do anything like that?
I'll see what my auntie and uncle want to do.
Yeah, there you go. Family first.
Yeah.
The views, information, and opinions expressed during the Dark Poutine podcast are solely those of the producer and do not necessarily represent those of Curious Cast, its affiliate, Global News, nor their parent company, Chorus Entertainment.
Dark Poutine is not for the faint of heart or squeamish. Listener discretion is strongly advised. We're not experts on the topics we present, nor are we journalists. We're two ordinary Canadians chatting about crime and the dark side of history. Let's get to it. Put on your toque, grab yourself a double-double and a Nanaimo bar. It's time to scarf down some Dark Poutine.
You are responsible for obtaining and maintaining at your own cost all equipment needed to listen to Dark Poutine. Dark Poutine can be addictive. Side effects may include, but not be limited to, pausing and questioning the system, elevated heart rate, pondering humanity, odd looks from colleagues as you laugh out loud at work, family members not into true crime worrying about you. Positive side effects may include some perspectives and opinions that you disagree with, as well as some wokeness and empathy. If you don't think Dark Poutine is for you, consult your doctor immediately.
In my first book, Murder, Madness, and Mayhem, I wrote about an unknown man whose body was found on Somerton Park Beach near Adelaide in Australia by two trainee jockeys who'd been out with their horses on the morning of December 1st, 1948. Lying in peaceful repose, the man wore a suit, overdressed for the warm Australian summer, and had no wallet or identification. He was unknown to anyone locally. The labels of his clothing had been ripped out. Some enigmatic leads proved fruitless, including the discovery of a book, the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam, believed to have belonged to the stranger. In that book, what appeared to be coded writing was found. Experts have yet to decrypt the supposed message. Some believe the man was a spy, possibly murdered for what he knew at the beginning of the Cold War. His identity has remained unknown for decades until recently, when two separate groups came forward claiming they had information about who he was, leading to further speculation and even more questions. This is Dark Poutine episode 309, Away Game, Not Quite Solved, Somerton Man Updates. In the wake of World War II, Adelaide, the coastal capital of South Australia, found itself on the cusp of transformation. The late 1940s ushered in a period of economic revival and demographic shift, positioning Adelaide as a burgeoning hub of post-war reconstruction and cultural diversity. This era saw the city's industries expand beyond their traditional agricultural roots, tapping into manufacturing and technology sectors, which promised new employment opportunities and a brighter future for its residents. Migration played a pivotal role in shaping the city's societal fabric. Adelaide welcomed a wave of new arrivals from Europe, drawn by the promise of peace and prosperity. These immigrants contributed to the multicultural mosaic of the city, introducing new traditions, cuisines, and languages, which enriched Adelaide's cultural landscape. I'm going to put on my best Tourism Australia voice here for this next bit. So bear with me. I know my accent's terrible, but I don't care. With its golden sands and tranquil waters, Somerton Beach offered a picturesque retreat from the city's rapid post-war development. Situated in the suburb of Glenelg, just 11 kilometres, 7 miles, southwest of Adelaide, it is more than just a popular leisure spot. It symbolised the Australian ideal of outdoor living and community engagement. Families gathered here for picnics and swims, reveling in the beauty of the South Australian coast. Worms and birds, my friends, worms and birds.
I can totally visualize one of those 1950s posters, you know, with the "Live in Somerton Beach" across the top, with like the beach and the parasol and the happy family. Right?
Or the 1948 poster, "Come to Die on Somerton Beach," maybe. Oh, oh dear.
Bad.
Against this backdrop of recovery and renewal, a mystery unfolded on Somerton Beach that would baffle the nation. In December 1948, discovering an unidentified man known as the Somerton Man on its shores added a layer of intrigue to the area's history. Dressed incongruously in a suit and tie with no identifying documents and found under circumstances suggesting neither suicide nor foul play, his identity and cause of death have remained unsolved mysteries. This case has fascinated true crime enthusiasts and amateur sleuths worldwide and highlighted the limits of forensic science and investigative techniques of the time. It all began on the evening of November 30th, 1948. John Baines Lyons, a jeweler by profession, and his wife took a leisurely walk along the shores of Somerton Beach. During their stroll, they encountered a peculiar and unsettling sight. A man, donned in formal attire, lay on the sand propped against the seawall in what seemed to be a state of repose. His body language suggested a casual relaxation, with his legs crossed and facing the ocean. From a distance of about 20 meters, the Lyons couple speculated whether the man was alive, their fears momentarily alleviated when they observed him make a feeble attempt to raise his arm, only for it to fall back in defeat. The gesture suggested a failed effort to light a cigarette. Misinterpreting his condition as a drunken stupor, possibly in premature celebration of the Australian summer, they decided to continue on their walk without intervening. The following morning, John Lyons returned to the beach for a swim and was met with the haunting realization that the man remained exactly where they'd left him, in the same pose. However, this time, two trainee jockeys were present, examining the man with curiosity and concern. Lyons approached, and together, the three discovered the grim truth. The man was deceased. At 6:35 a.m., Lyons contacted the Brighton police to report the discovery. The deceased was notably overdressed for a beach setting, clad in a fawn-colored suit, double-breasted jacket, shirt, tie, and brown shoes, though conspicuously without a hat, an essential accessory in that era. An unlit cigarette rested on his lapel, likely the same one the Lyons had witnessed in his failed attempt to smoke the day before. Despite the grim circumstances, the man's expression remained eerily peaceful.
Part of what makes this case so intriguing to me is how it's almost Agatha Christie-esque. It's like an Agatha Christie novel.
It is, yeah.
You have the setting, you have the beach, you have the players, like the dead man who moved his arm, the jeweler and his wife who saw him, the two trainee jockeys, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that also makes me think Wes Anderson should do Agatha Christie films.
Yeah.
Imagine Agatha Christie stories done by Wes Anderson. They'd be fantastic.
They would be awesome. Around daybreak at 6:45 a.m., law enforcement officials arrived at Somerton Beach to attend to the man found unresponsive, showing no outward signs of a struggle or violence, no bloodshed, Bruises, bullet wounds, or stab injuries were visible. Swiftly, they transported him to a local hospital where Dr. John Barclay Bennett officially declared the man deceased, suspecting heart failure around 2 a.m. as the cause, albeit without pinpointing an exact reason for his demise. The immediate task following the declaration of death was to identify the deceased and notify his kin. However, this proved challenging as the man carried no identifying documents, not even a wallet, and he carried no cash. The man's attire, a suit too thick for the local climate, hinted at origins from a colder region, suggesting his journey to this particular beach might have been purposeful, albeit ending in his mysterious demise. His garments showed peculiarities. Trousers, crudely mended with orange thread, a formal ensemble of a white shirt, brown pullover, a tricolored tie, and meticulously polished brown shoes, curiously prepared as if for his own dignified burial. Strikingly, all labels from his clothing were removed, erasing potential clues to his identity. This deliberate act suggested a meticulous effort to obscure his identification. The man's personal belongings, though sparse, offered glimpses into his movements and possible origins. Railway and bus tickets suggested local travel. A mix of American and British tobacco products indicated international connections. And a small piece of paper with Tamam Shud printed in a distinct font hinted at a Middle Eastern connection, translating from Persian to "It is ended." This fact has always raised eyebrows and has been used as a possible lead toward identifying the man. Amidst this investigation, Dr. John Matthew Dwyer conducted an autopsy, noting the absence of external injuries or signs of violence on the well-groomed, physically fit man, aged between 40 and 50, with distinctive features such as unique ear shapes and pointed toes, possibly from wearing pointy shoes. Despite these details, his identity remained elusive.
Pointy shoes. Maybe he was a goth wearing fluvogs. Remember those early fluvogs, the super pointy ones that he did?
I remember those. And my friend Kevin Wharton, who is an architect, I grew up with him in Bridgewater. He actually designed the John Fluvog store that is in Gastown.
The flagship store.
That's right. Yeah. The man's autopsy revealed a healthy heart, albeit contracted, and congested lungs with the presence of a recent meal suggesting sudden death, potentially from poisoning. However, no specific toxin was identified immediately. Samples were dispatched for laboratory analysis in hopes of uncovering more about the mysterious substance that may have led to his demise. Robert James Cowan, the deputy government analyst, concluded his meticulous examination without finding traces of conventional toxins, leading to a pivotal moment in the coronial inquest. Cowan speculated, as noted in the inquest report, that if poison was indeed the cause of death, it must have been an extraordinarily uncommon one, perhaps a substance not typically associated with either suicide or homicide. Despite leaning toward natural causes, Cowan acknowledged the presence of indicators in the tissue samples that might suggest poisoning. Dr. John Matthew Dwyer, echoing Cowan's cautious approach, pointed to the potential involvement of certain rapid-acting barbiturates or other swiftly degrading poisons that could elude detection post-mortem. Dwyer reinforced his hypothesis by referencing literature on how certain barbiturates vanish quickly after death, underlining the complexity of determining a definitive cause of death in such perplexing circumstances. The inquiry ultimately classified the cause of death as heart failure, likely induced by an unspecified poison. This conclusion propelled investigators to a complex web of possibilities, pondering whether the mysterious man had met his end through self-administration of the toxin, or if it was the work of another's hand. In the wake of these findings on January 11, 1949, police intensified their efforts to piece together the man's last days by reaching out to local establishments, hotels, dry cleaners, bus depots, and train stations, urging them to report any unclaimed items that could shed light on the enigmatic stranger's identity. On January 14th, detectives made their way to the Adelaide Railway Station to inspect a suitcase that had been left in the cloakroom since November 30th, the eve of the discovery of the unidentified man's body on Somerton Beach. Echoing the mystery of the man's attire, the suitcase bore no manufacturing label or any distinctive identification marks, mirroring its potential owner's anonymity. The contents of the suitcase further cemented its connection to the Somerton man. Among the items was a tin of brown shoe polish, identical to the one used on the shoes found with the deceased, and a spool of Barber's brand orange thread, remarkably similar to the thread used for the makeshift repair on the man's trousers. Microscopic examination confirmed the threads were an exact match. Inside the suitcase were various clothing items perfectly fitting the man's measurements, including two sleeveless undershirts, underpants, long pants showing signs of recent dry cleaning, and a single sixpence, the sole piece of cash linked to his belongings. Another sports coat, shirts, and pajamas were also found, all devoid of tags, alongside grooming essentials typical for a traveler, yet none provided significant leads. A curious discovery within the suitcase was a laundry bag and a sleeveless undershirt marked with Keane, K-E-A-N-E, and Keane, K-E-A-N, respectively. This potential clue or deliberate misdirection, whether an alias or a decoy, failed to advance the investigation, leading to a dead end. By February 1949, authorities explored no less than 8 potential identifications for the mysterious figure, all of which were disproven as those individuals were found to be either alive or confirmed deceased elsewhere. Efforts to match the man's fingerprints internationally through Scotland Yard and the FBI yielded no results, leaving Australian officials as mystified as they were upon the initial discovery by Lyons and the trainee jockeys.
You know, I find it really interesting that back then, all the way from Adelaide, Australia, the police are connecting with Scotland Yard and the FBI.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't realize there was that much reach back then, you know
sure.
what I mean?
Yep.
And Mike, why would they go to Scotland Yard instead of MI5 or MI6, which are both around for about 40 years at that point?
Well, maybe MI5 and MI6, they're not thinking this guy's a spy, he's just some dude, okay. You know? So that might be the thing that would facilitate contact with those organizations, and they might have done that and just not said anything about it. Months pass with the man remaining unidentified, and on June 14, 1949, he was laid to rest. The service, conducted in secrecy by Captain E.J. Webb of the Salvation Army to deter public curiosity, reflected the intense media and public interest surrounding the case. His grave was sealed in concrete, a measure taken with the foresight that a relative might one day claim his remains for repatriation. A donated headstone marks his resting place with an inscription commemorating the Somerton man's enduring mystery.
You know, I love that people care, or cared, you know, they have no idea who this guy is.
Yeah, it's a stranger. Yeah.
But they didn't just cremate or bury him. They care enough to think that someday his remains would be reinterred or whatever it's called to the family.
Brought home.
Brought home. Yeah. And that he deserved a headstone. And I wonder if we'd do that today.
I don't know. I think it depends on the amount of attention something gets.
Yeah.
Authorities launched a public appeal seeking the source of the tam and shud scrap found with the deceased, a phrase from a book. Literary experts identified the fragment as originating from the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam, a collection of quatrains by the Persian astronomer-poet, dating back to the 11th century. The Rubaiyat's popularity in the Western world surged following its first English translation in 1859, suggesting the Somerton man's familiarity with this literary work indicated a well-educated background. Despite extensive searches in bookstores and libraries for a matching copy, investigators initially came up empty-handed. The case took a significant turn when Adelaide chemist Roland Francis, a pseudonym, reported that his brother-in-law had found a peculiar copy of the Rubaiyat in his parked car near Somerton Beach around the time the body was discovered. Upon retrieval and examination by the police on July 23, 1949, it was revealed to be a rare first edition of Edward Fitzgerald's translation, published in New Zealand by Whitcomb and Toombs in 1859. The book contained a torn back page that, upon expert analysis, matched the scrap found with the body, confirming its origin. However, the book's discovery introduced new questions rather than provided answers. Notably, alongside two phone numbers was a cryptic pencil-written code on its back page. The first bit of text was WRGOABABD, and then the second line crossed out was MLIAOI, followed by WTBIMPANETP, and then an asterisk, MLIABOAIAQC, followed by ITTMTSAMSTGAB.
WTFLOL.
Exactly, WTF. Oh boy. The mysterious code found in association with the Somerton Man case has puzzled experts and enthusiasts alike since its discovery. Initially, there was speculation that the sequence of letters might represent words in a foreign language. However, this theory was soon dismissed in favor of the possibility that it was an encrypted message. The code remains undeciphered despite the involvement of code experts and amateur sleuths. In 1978, ABC Television's journalist Stuart Littlemore enlisted cryptographers from the Australian Department of Defense to scrutinize the handwritten text. Their analysis concluded that, due to the code's concise nature, it lacked enough symbols to extract a definitive meaning, suggesting it might be an unsolvable encryption or nonsensical text produced by a troubled mind. One of the phone numbers found with the code was traced back to Jessica Ellen Joe Thompson, born Jessie Harkness, a nurse residing in Mosley Street, Glenelg, at the time of the stranger's discovery. Jessica's address was notably close, 400 meters away, to where the unidentified man's body was discovered. Thompson, born in 1921 in the Sydney suburb of Merrickville, New South Wales, was entangled in the mystery when police sought her insight. Upon viewing a plaster cast bust of the Somerton Man presented by Detective Sergeant Lean, Ms. Thompson was shocked, appearing as though she might faint, a response that Lean interpreted as a significant emotional reaction. Paul Lawson, the technician who created the cast, witnessed Thompson's reaction, observed that she refused to look at the bust again after her initial glance. But she said, you know, she didn't know who it was, even though she reacted that way.
Either she didn't like seeing the cast of a dead person, or did she know him? Maybe. You know, she seems really evasive about all of this.
Yeah, she was a pretty cagey character, which is interesting. Maybe she just didn't want to get involved, or maybe there was something else that was going on. We may learn more about that later. Despite her claims of not recognizing the deceased or understanding why he possessed her contact information, Thompson divulged a peculiar incident from late 1948. During this period, an unknown individual had made inquiries about her to a neighbor, suggesting an attempt to visit her. This revelation added layers to the intrigue, indicating a possible connection between Thompson and the mysterious visitor, whose presence in her suburb coincided with the night of his untimely death. The implications of this encounter remain a subject of speculation, contributing to the web of mystery surrounding the Somerton Man case. In 1949, Jessica Thompson requested that the police keep her identity confidential and that it not be disclosed to external parties, citing concerns over the potential damage to her reputation from being associated with the case. The police complied with her request, which later proved to be a complicating factor for subsequent investigations. In various accounts and analyses of the case, Thompson was referred to by pseudonyms, most notably Jestin, and occasionally by other names such as Teresa Johnson Bourne Powell. In 2010, retired detective Gary Feltus claimed he had received the family's permission to reveal Thompson's and her husband Prosper Thompson's names, although he ultimately chose to use pseudonyms in his publication. Felton also noted that Thompson's family was unaware of her link to the case and he respected their privacy by not revealing her true identity, which some believe could be crucial in deciphering the code associated with the case. For 74 years, the man's identity remained an evergreen mystery and the code associated with him unsolved. the curious and investigators continue speculating that others murdered him for reasons yet obscure. More after a quick break.
If you're looking for a smoking gun, I can absolutely guarantee you, you will not find it.
In October 2001, a series of letters filled with a deadly powder called anthrax were dropped into the U.S. mail system. What started as an unprecedented case turned into an unsettling mystery. Who sent these deadly letters, and why? From Campside Media and Sony Music Entertainment, I'm Josh Dean, and this is Cover Up Season 4, The Anthrax Threat, available now.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit amazon.com/prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
This episode is brought to you by AutoTrader. Credit scores, down payments, interest rates. Car buying can be a numbers game, but you don't have to be a math expert to get the keys to your dream car. Just use Kelley Blue Book My Wallet on AutoTrader. You can crunch the numbers so you know exactly how much you'll pay each month for your car. So leave the calculator at home. Visit AutoTrader.com to learn more.
And we are back. Matthew, thoughts so far on Somerton Man?
I can understand why you did part of your one of your chapters in your book was about this, because it's such a fascinating case. Mm-hmm. And like, how big was the publicity back then for it?
Massive.
It was huge. Was it? Yeah. You probably had lots of material to go through for this episode.
So many newspaper articles, so many documentaries, like. You name it, it's still an enduring mystery, and we'll get into why. It gets even stranger more recently when it looks like it's about to be solved.
How can it be possibly any stranger than it is now?
Well, we'll get into that.
Stay tuned.
Stay tuned, folks. In 2004, aforementioned author Gary Feltus proposed an intriguing interpretation in a Sunday Mail article suggesting the last line of code, ITTMTSAMSTGAB, could potentially represent the initial letters of the phrase, "It's time to move to South Australia, Mosley Street," a direct reference to Mosley Street in Glenelg, where Jessica Thompson, this woman we mentioned who is closely linked to the case, resided. Enter Derek Abbott, a researcher deeply invested in the Somerton Man mystery. Between 2009 and 2011, Abbott and his team ventured into a detailed examination of the cryptic letters. They theorized that each letter was likely the initial of an English word, aligning with Feltus's earlier speculation but broadening the scope of interpretation. Despite this advancement, a conclusive explanation for the code remained elusive. There have been many theories about the Somerton Man, some claiming he was a spy and possibly killed for what he knew. The theories stem from several intriguing aspects of the case, including the cryptic code found in the Rubaiyat, his unidentified status, the mysterious circumstances of his death, and the geopolitical context of the time. These elements collectively fueled speculation about his possible involvement in espionage activities, particularly during the early years of the Cold War. Further fueling these speculations beyond the presence of the cryptic code was the careful removal of all labels from his clothing and the absence of identifying documents suggesting to some that the stranger was involved in clandestine activities. The lack of a clear cause of death and suggestion of poison without any trace in the autopsy report further contribute to the spy theory. Some forms of poison known to be used by intelligence agencies leave no trace, leading to speculation that the Somerton Man might have been silenced. The late 1940s was a time of escalating tensions between Western powers and the Soviet Union, marking the onset of the Cold War. Australia was increasingly involved in intelligence activities and counter-espionage efforts against Soviet spies. The idea that the Somerton man could be a spy fits within this historical context, suggesting he might have been involved in intelligence work that led to his death. Jessica Jestin Thompson reportedly knew about spying and spoke Russian, which added to the mystery. During the Cold War era, Russian language skills were uncommon among Australians. This fact would have shed suspicion upon Thompson. Anecdotal evidence and rumors have circulated about Thompson's lifestyle and social circles, suggesting she may have had connections to individuals involved in intelligence or espionage. However, these claims lack solid documentation and are often based on hearsay. In his book, The Unknown Man, Gary Feltus noted that Jestin's background and her evasive behavior when questioned by police might indicate she knew more about the man's identity and possibly his espionage activities. Feltus mentioned the possibility of the Somerton man being involved in espionage, but acknowledged the lack of concrete evidence, stating, quote, "The espionage theory adds an element of intrigue, but it is not substantiated by hard evidence," end quote. Professor Derek Abbott suggested that the Cold War context could not be ignored, noting, quote, "Given the start of the Cold War and the fact that electronic espionage was in its infancy, human intelligence and messages were key," end quote.
Yeah, we weren't all connected with computers like we are now.
No.
And if you think about it, everything's connected, and hackers can really almost get into anywhere if they want to.
Yeah.
But I do like the old school spy stories and movies where people have to, like, sit beside somebody on a park bench and lean over and say things like, "The pearl is in the river."
Or, "The frost is on the pumpkin."
"Oh, it's you."
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
"You are my contact."
Yeah.
"Here is the microfilm."
That's what I was just going to say. "Matthew, where is the microfilm?" A 2014 analysis by computational linguist John Rayling leveraged extensive literature reviews to match the sequence of letters in the alleged code in the copy of the Rubaiyat believed to have belonged to the stranger. Rayling's findings supported the notion that the letters represented initials of some form of English text, but his comprehensive search failed to uncover any matching phrases or sentences. Consequently, Rayling posited that the letters might have been intended as a shorthand rather than a traditional code, suggesting the true meaning or original text behind these initials might never be uncovered. After 2014, interest in the case and its associated code continued among cryptographers, historians, and amateur sleuths, largely facilitated by technological advances and the wider availability of cryptographic tools to the public. The internet has allowed for greater collaboration and the exchange of ideas among those interested in the case from around the world. However, specific details about post-2014 analyses that have led to new concrete insights or breakthroughs are scarce, as much of the work is ongoing and often shared within niche communities and not widely publicized. Deciphering the code associated with the Somerton Man case is a challenging task that has stumped both professional and amateur cryptanalysts for decades. Without a key or a clear understanding of the method used to create the cipher, any attempt to decode it is speculative. However, considering this exercise's limitations and speculative nature, here's a general approach of how one might attempt to decipher such a code. The code consists of several lines of letters, which at first do not form recognizable words or phrases in English. A few characteristics stand out. The absence of vowels in some segments makes it unlikely to be straightforward text. Repeating certain sequences, AB, appears more than once, could hint at a pattern or be a red herring. The isolated asterisk in the original code could indicate a break, a space, or a missing element. Cryptographic techniques used have included frequency analysis. This is typically the first step in attempting to crack a cipher. In this step, you analyze the frequency of each letter's appearance compared to typical later frequencies in the English language. However, the short length of this text makes frequency analysis challenging. Pattern recognition. For repeating patterns or sequences that might suggest an encryption method, the repetition of AB could be significant. Substitution cipher. One might speculate if each letter could represent another letter, number, or symbol. Trying simple substitution based on common letter frequencies, e.g. E is the most common letter in English, could be a start. Transposition cipher. If the letters are scrambled in a particular order, they require reordering based on a key or pattern. One-time pad. If the code is generated using a one-time pad cipher, it would be uncrackable without access to the exact key to the encrypt text. Acronym or initialism. Given the speculation around this code, one theory is that each letter stands for the first letter of a word in a phrase or sentence. This approach aligns with some interpretations, but it requires substantial guesswork without additional context. Two of the main limitations and challenges in solving the cipher are, of course, lack of context. Without knowing the context or method of encryption, any attempt at decryption is speculative. Possibility of nonsense. The code might not be a cipher, but rather a random collection of letters or something meaningful only to the Somerton man and or individuals directly involved. The interest in this code continues, and perhaps future advancements in cryptography, new information about the case, or insights from the public might shed light on this enduring mystery.
Maybe he was just trying to figure out a crossword puzzle.
Could have been.
Like, can you imagine everyone's like killing themselves over this?
Mm-hmm.
And it was just some dude trying to like figure out a crossword puzzle.
Yeah, it's like in Halifax paper, we used to have the cryptogram that my mom and my grandmother used to do. And then later on, I started doing it too. It was really fun. But yeah, it could have been something that simple. In 2021, a pivotal development occurred in the long-standing mystery of the Somerton Man when South Australian police, in collaboration with the state coroner, exhumed the unidentified man's body to undertake DNA analysis. Before completing this forensic endeavor, Professor Derek Abbott, alongside American genealogist Colleen Fitzpatrick, announced a breakthrough in the summer of 2022. They claim to have unlocked the identity of Somerton Man through sophisticated DNA techniques. This revelation came after the South Australian police provided Professor Abbott's team with hair samples taken from a plaster cast made of the man's face in 1949, intended for identification purposes. Utilizing these samples, a team of experts at the Australian Centre for Ancient DNA at the University of Adelaide successfully extracted DNA in 2012. Over the following decade, Abbott and Fitzpatrick employed numerous DNA databases to construct a comprehensive family tree encompassing over 4,000 individuals, ultimately converging on one individual. Although some theories about the stranger's identity have been fantastical and intriguing, the information unveiled by Abbott and Fitzpatrick is a tale tinged with tragedy rather than espionage. As Ben Cheshire of ABC News Australia reported, the researchers identified Somerton Man as Charles Carl Webb, a Melbourne native born in 1905. Richard August Webb, a German immigrant from Hamburg, settled in Australia and alongside his wife Eliza Amelia Morris Grace, whom he married in 1892, established a bakery in Springvale, Victoria. The couple's life together marked the beginning of a family that would face a blend of ordinary and extraordinary challenges. Their youngest child, Carl Charles Webb, was born on November 16, 1905, in the Melbourne suburb of Footscray. Growing up in a bustling household as the youngest of six, Carl and his brothers eventually contributed to the family business, working in the bakery. However, the bakery's closure led Carl to pivot professionally, retraining as an electrical instrument maker, showcasing the adaptability that seemed to characterize his early years. In 1941, Carl married Dorothy Doff Robertson, a pharmacist and chiropodist. The newlyweds set up their home in a flat on Bromby Street, South Yarra, and embarking on a shared life that would soon prove to be tumultuous. Carl was described by Dorothy as a solitary figure, preferring the quiet life, but also prone to moodiness, aggression, and a predilection for poetry that often dwelled on themes of death, a fascination mirrored in his admiration for the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam, a book renowned for its contemplations of life's transience and the inevitability of death. The relationship was marred by discord attributed to Carl's volatile behavior, which included threats and physical violence over minor defeats. Dorothy recounted a distressing episode in March 1946 where Carl allegedly attempted to die by suicide using an ether overdose. Despite her efforts to nurse him back to health, the episode only exacerbated the violence in their relationship, leading Dorothy to leave in September 1946. Carl departed their shared home the following year, disappearing into obscurity with no subsequent records of his whereabouts found by 2022. By 1951, Dorothy was living in Butte, South Australia, a significant distance from Adelaide. Derek Abbott speculated that Carl might have traveled to Adelaide in an attempt to locate Dorothy. Dorothy filed for divorce in 1951 on grounds of desertion, officially dissolving their marriage in April 1952. The Webb family's narrative also intertwined with American connections. Carl's oldest sister, Frieda Grace, was married to Thomas Geraldine Keene, and their son, John, who perished in World War II, possessed items indicative of time spent in the United States. The link possibly explains the American origin clothing found on the Somerton man and the name Keene associated with some belongings, hinting at a familial hand-me-down or emblematic keepsake. Amidst a background of personal loss, including the deaths of four close relatives over 7 years, Carl's life narrative is marked by speculation of mental health struggles and a descent into despair. Abbott's investigation, supported by the expertise of Colleen Fitzpatrick, leans toward the conclusion that Carl Webb, grappling with profound grief and isolation, ultimately chose to end his life by suicide, with the circumstances of his death on Somerton Beach suggesting a poignant final chapter to a life enveloped in mystery and tragedy. But the story doesn't end here. Regardless of that DNA evidence and the family tree that was built, according to the Adelaide Now newspaper, Sophie Holzman, a lawyer for the family and friends of a man from Austria, Carl Joseph Halben, claimed he is the Somerton man. Holzman challenges the conclusion come to by Abbott and Fitzpatrick, saying their investigation is flawed. Holzman describes Carl Halben as a milliner, sailor, communist, spy, expressing a desire for the truth of his identity to be revealed. A note signed by Halben's family, including, quote, Sophie and your beloved Justin, was recently placed by Holzman at a memorial for the Somerton man.
But wait a minute, isn't DNA DNA?
Well, this is the thing, Matthew. I don't know, is it?
Well, it is.
It is, it absolutely is. But I get into that right at the very end of this episode.
Okay.
And there's more compelling evidence. Holzman, who has been investigating this case for 2 years, alleges that Carl Halben was an Austrian communist and spy with a cousin involved in atomic bomb research in the UK. She has submitted Halben's name and findings to the South Australian police and is collaborating with his family in the US and Europe to unveil the truth. Her research contradicts recent investigations, pointing to Carl Charles Webb as a Somerton man, especially regarding DNA tests by Professor Derek Abbott of Adelaide University, which linked the body to Webb's relatives. Holzman argues that the Somerton man's exposure to strontium-90 suggests he had been at atomic testing sites, a journey Carl Webb, who never traveled internationally, could not have made. So perhaps the family tree built by Abbott and Fitzgerald is wrong. Holzman's findings, which she claims are supported by expert evidence and match all known physical characteristics of Somerton Man, are set to be featured in an upcoming TV documentary. I really want to see that. She has formally submitted the case to the South Australian coroner and contacted various government officials seeking a reevaluation of the case based on her evidence. SA police have stated that the investigation remains ongoing, while authorities express cautious optimism about the potential breakthrough of these the potential breakthrough these new claims may offer, pending further DNA analysis and official determination by the coroner. Perhaps Holzman is correct. The two men look similar in close-up photos. Halbin's receding hairline is problematic due to the Somerton man's full head of hair. Perhaps his hair was combed forward in the death photo, as in the death mask it appears to be further receding. A side-by-side photo comparison of the Somerton man and a younger Carl Webb, while appearing quite similar at first, on further inspection, there are issues like Carl Webb's crooked nose and Somerton man's, which is perfectly straight. In a hopeful yet reserved statement on Twitter, a police spokesman expressed optimism about the recent developments potentially leading to a conclusive resolution of the Somerton man's identity, pending further DNA analysis and the coroner's final determination. Here it begs the question, are these two people the same man somehow? Did this guy lead two lives, maybe?
Interesting.
Very, very interesting.
The young Carl Webb was good looking.
Was he? Well, there you go.
Look at that picture of him. He's kind of handsome.
He was kind of handsome, yeah. But, you know, who knows what's going on?
Maybe he was a spy and he had two identities.
Maybe. Mm-hmm. Really fascinating. Anyway. And that's it for Dark Poutine episode 309, Away Game, Not Quite Solved, Somerton Man Updates.
This is NASCAR driver Tony Breidinger inviting you to make a pit stop at Raising Cane's for craveable, hand-battered, cooked-to-order chicken fingers.
Chicken up.
Crispy, crinkle-cut fries.
Hot potato coming through.
Buttery Texas toast.
Toast walking.
And secret Cane's sauce.
Topping off now.
Turbocharge your chicken fingers and get them even faster when you order online or with the Raising Cane's app.
Go, go, go!
Raising Cane's chicken fingers. One love. Raising Cane's is not affiliated with NASCAR.
That's right. It's time for voicemails. You can leave us a message at 1-877-327-5786 or 1-877-DARK-PTN. We'd love to hear from you. Let's see who called us this week.
Well, let's see who called us this week. I think we have a voicemail to listen to, which is very nice. Here it is.
Hi, gents. My name's Christina, and I am from Minnesota, you know, Canada Light. And I just found your podcast, like, maybe about 5 episodes back, and I finished listening to Apex Predator and heard that you guys needed a voicemail. So I am calling just to leave you a pleasant message. Thank you for doing what you do. Thank you for doing it with humor. And I appreciate you guys. So have a fantastic day out there in Canada. Down here in Minnesota, we still don't have snow on March 4th. So, yeah, have a great day.
Wow. No snow in Minnesota. That's, like, noteworthy, isn't it?
We got all your snow this winter then.
We did? I haven't seen any snow, really.
I'm in Alberta right now, and yeah, we got some snow.
Oh, yeah, well, there you go.
Minnesota, I think she's from St. Cloud.
St. Cloud, Minnesota, like Betty White's character in The Golden Girls?
Yeah, and a good friend of mine grew up in St. Cloud.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Interesting. What does our friend do in St. Cloud, Minnesota?
She runs a vape shop called Clouds.
Clouds.
Clouds and St. Clouds.
There you go. Clouds and St. Clouds. I don't know. I quit smoking before the vape thing became a thing.
You're so that old.
I'm that old. I'm quit smoking that old. But I never tried it. Did you ever vape?
Yes.
Yeah. And you hate it.
My husband did.
Oh, there you go. So you didn't hate it so much, but your husband hated it.
So I have nicotine gum instead.
So now you chew nicotine gum like, as my mother would say, a cow chewing its cud. The look on Matthew's face is priceless.
No, it's just, I was talking to somebody that I work with, and he's like, you're always like chewing away, and you just like, you do your thing, and you'll take a piece of gum out of your mouth, stick another one in, but you keep going, you don't even miss a beat.
Oh, dear.
That's it for this week's voicemails. Again, you can leave us one at 1-877-327-5786 or 1-877-DARK-PTN. We'd love to hear from you, even if it is just to say hi and to tell us to go shit in our hats. If you're stumped for what to chat with us about, a quick story is welcome.
We have some patrons.
Oh, yay.
This week.
Patreon.
So first up, from Sherman Oaks, California, Akiko Abe. Akiko Abe. That's cool. We have somebody who is clearly Japanese of heritage. Akiko Abe. And what does Akiko do there in Sherman Oaks? Probably work in the movie business somewhere.
Yeah, I think Akiko Abe is, that's her code name.
Okay. Yeah. So a spy?
Yeah.
Okay. And what particular organization does she spy for, Matthew?
Oh, she's like a triple agent.
Oh, triple agent.
Yeah. Well, no, at least a double agent. So she's actually Akiko.
Are you blowing up her spot? Like, this could be dangerous.
Akiko is originally from Canada.
Okay.
And so she works for CSIS.
CSIS. Okay.
But the Canadians don't know that she also works for the CIA.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So she's
Well, they do now if they're listening to this podcast. She's doing a little,
sorry to blow your cover.
Oh, well. And then we lost a patron because Akiko has passed away.
No.
She's been assassinated.
No.
Oh, well, hopefully not. Like,
I want to know what Akiko actually does. Call in and tell us.
Yes, I'm fascinated. Please, Akiko, give us a call.
Why do I know Sherman Oaks? Why do I know the name?
We just hear it a lot, and when in movies and that kind of stuff.
Is that where it's from? Okay.
Yeah.
It's so funny how all over the world, everyone knows all the neighborhoods in California because of the movies.
Yeah, it's funny. And some people think that, oh, this is a neighborhood in California that's actually a neighborhood in Vancouver. Anyway, we do have another patron, and this one is from my home stomping grounds, Nova Scotia. Her name is Kimberly Lowe, and she's from South Maitland, Nova Scotia. Thank you so much, Kimberly. Much appreciated.
Where's South Maitland?
Well, South Maitland is just probably south of Middle Maitland.
and a couple down from North Maitland?
Yeah, there's like... this one is actually in Hants County. So there's a few Maitlands in Nova Scotia. But this in particular one is in the municipal district of East Hants in Hants County, Nova Scotia. And that is close to where I was conceived. So, So well, how about them apples?
Well, she works at the hospital.
Does she? I don't think there's a hospital in South Maitland.
So she's a pediatric doctor. So maybe she pulled you out.
I don't know. She'd have to be a pretty old one right now because, like I said to my friend, I'm almost cheap breakfast at Denny's old. Anyway, thank you so much for doing what you do, Kimberly. Much appreciated.
And thank you, Akiko and Kimberly, both for becoming patrons. It means a lot to us.
So it looks like we had a few Donut Money donors here this week. First up, we have Mary Degnan, and Mary is from, looks like, Flagstaff, Arizona, and she says a couple double doubles and some donuts. Ah. How about that? Thank you, Mary.
Thanks, Mary. And Mary, make sure that everyone in Flagstone don't forget Winona.
Doesn't forget Winona?
Yeah, okay. She makes sure people don't forget Winona.
Oh, there you go. Yeah, well, that's nice.
Her job.
Very nice.
Keeping Winona on everyone's minds.
Our next Donut Money donor is Bernadette PC. And Bernadette is from Lisbon Falls in Maine. Another one from sort of my neck of the woods. And she says, Donut Money, good job covering the main story. Appreciate your hard work, Bernadette. Well, thank you, Bernadette.
I wonder if Bernadette knows the song by Leonard Cohen called "Song of Bernadette." If Bernadette, if you haven't heard it, play it. It's beautiful.
Oh,
yes.
I'm gonna have to listen to that one too. I think it sounds nice. I like that name, Bernadette.
Yeah, I really do. It's a good name.
Yeah.
It's the song's about the little girl who saw the Virgin Mary.
Oh, well, yeah. There you go. Was that the like in Lourdes?
No.
Okay. All right. I don't know where it is then. And we have...
Maybe it was.
Matthew should get his facts straight, both of us, before we say anything. We should actually get our facts straight. But we do have another Donut Money donor, so that makes three this week. And that person's name is Kara Valiquette. If I'm pronouncing it correctly, it's V-A-L-I-Q-U-E-T-T-E.
Valiquette.
Valiquette. Okay. And Kara is from Bracebridge, Ontario.
Bracebridge, Ontario.
Do you know where that is?
I do know where it is.
Mm-hmm.
Bracebridge, Ontario. I can't remember what is in Bracebridge, but it's not far from... Well, Bracebridge is up near... I think it's like the Muskokas.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, near Gravenhurst.
Well, there you go. And
it's beautiful up there.
So what does Kara do in Bracebridge then?
She sits on the dock and watches the loons with her cup of coffee.
Well, who wouldn't want to do that?
Thank you so much, Kara. and Bernadette, in Lourdes, yes.
Okay, there you go.
I just last year read an entire book about it. Totally forgot.
I don't know. I read so many books, they go out of my brain pretty quickly now. And it doesn't help that I'm writing them too.
Yeah, and it's age as well for me.
What did you say? Anyway, well, thank you so much to our patrons and our Donut Money donors. We appreciate you so much.
We do.
Thanks to all our patrons and Donut Money donors, past and present, for your generosity. It helps to keep the show going. You can become a patron of Dark Poutine at patreon.com/darkpoutine. For a one-time donation, you can send us Donut Money via PayPal using our email address, darkpoutinepodcast@gmail.com. If you don't already subscribe to the show, it would mean a lot if you did. You can easily find Dark Poutine on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows. If you haven't gotten yours yet, my book, Murder, Madness, and Mayhem, is available to order via a link on the Dark Poutine website. And speaking of darkpoutine.com, please check it out for show notes and other cool stuff. We'd appreciate it if you took the time to give Dark Poutine a like or a follow on Facebook and Instagram. Most importantly, thank you for listening, and tell your friends about us. Word of mouth is a powerful thing. And that's it for this episode of Dark Poutine.
Are we done already?
We are done already. So until next time, don't forget to be a good egg and not a bad apple.
Bye, y'all.
Bye.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink.
All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone.
Like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.